Shalom, welcome to SJTF. This is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to elevating the souls of Simcha Chasdai, Pesach Ben Dov, Meir Ben Yecheskel, and Yosef Ben Meir. Before we get to our questions from our great JTFers, I want to remind everybody that 1 year ago, at this time, everything seemed hopeless. You remember Barack Hussein Obama was re-elected to a second term, and he got a majority of the vote, he got 51% of the vote, and we had tried so hard to defeat him. We worked very hard to do everything we could to defeat him. We and other people and other groups that tried to defeat him did not succeed. And it really looked like a hopeless situation because demographically the country is becoming more and more non-white. More of the groups that vote automatically Democrat by overwhelming margins are becoming a bigger and bigger percentage of the population. And there seemed to be almost an automatic majority for the left-wing Democrat policies of Barack Hussein Obama and then eventually for Hillary Clinton. The polls showed that Hillary Clinton was the overwhelming favorite to become the next president of the United States. The polls still show that she has a big lead. Although her lead has gone down somewhat, the polls show she still has a big lead. But the situation a year ago really seemed hopeless. It was a devastating blow when Barack Hussein Obama was reelected. And at the time, if you recall, we said on program after program, post-election, we said over and over again on every program that we did that the only hope at this point to save America and the only hope to have a pro-Israel president, a president that won't pressure Israel to commit suicide, the only hope for ever achieving that now in the future would be if there was a big backlash against Obama's policies, because Obama's policies are doomed to fail. You remember, we said that Obama's policies eventually will fail. We always said that. And we said that when they fail, if there is a big backlash among the American people, there might still be a chance for turning the situation around, as hopeless as everything seemed at the time. If there's a big backlash, that's the last hope we have. You remember we kept repeating that over and over again? What we said then is still true now. And look at what's happening with Obamacare and with the website and with the catastrophe that they're facing. They got only 6 people to enroll in Obamacare on the first day that the website rolled out on October 1st of this year. Only 6 people enrolled in a nation of over 300 million Americans. The second day, it was 200 plus people. I don't remember the exact number. It was over 200 people enrolling. This has been such a disaster, such a dismal failure, such a joke. They spent over $600 million on a website that shouldn't have cost more than $1 million. And the website doesn't even work. The website is a catastrophe. This should really show us what happens when big government attempts to do things that should be done by private industry. And even when big government employs private firms and private companies to do things, it doesn't work out because big government and big bureaucracy and big regulations make it impossible even for private industry to succeed and to flourish. Now, they're going to correct the problems on this website eventually. I hope they don't. God willing, I hope they never do. I hope the whole thing collapses. But probably, they're probably going to correct the problems on the website in the upcoming weeks. They've brought in people from Google and from all these other sites. And, you know, now they're spending, I don't know how much more taxpayer money. Before they put the website out, they spent over $600 million on a website that doesn't work. But as a result of this introduction to Obamacare, poll numbers are down now for Barack Hussein Obama and for Hillary Clinton, because she's a Democrat who also supported Obamacare because she was Secretary of State under Obama. You know, she was his Secretary of State. She has supported Obamacare loyally. And she herself proposed Hillary Care, which was even more socialistic than Obamacare. She was proposing an even more grotesque government takeover of the healthcare industry in the 1990s, in 1993. A Democrat Congress rejected Hillary Care. That's how extreme it was. The Democrats controlled both houses of Congress when Bill and Hillary polluted, first came into the office of the White House and polluted the White House with their nasty satanic presence. And they couldn't get Hillary Care passed in 93. In a Democrat-controlled House and Democrat-controlled Senate, they couldn't get it passed. And so poll numbers now, because she's identified with this too, poll numbers now are down for her as well. Especially among young voters. The biggest drop is among young voters, and that's the future of the country. Remember, young voters voted 2-1 for Obama in the past two elections. It went down a little bit. It was actually, I don't remember the exact figures, but it was almost 2-1 in 2008 for Obama, and then it was a little bit less in 2012. I don't remember the exact figures, but it was in the 60s. He got in the 60s among younger voters, and I define younger voters voters between the ages of 18 and 29, anyone who's under 30, I define those, that's how I define younger voters, 18 to 29. That group was overwhelmingly for Obama and overwhelmingly Democrat, overwhelmingly left-wing. Because that group, the only thing they have in their memory other than Obama is George W. Bush, who was, of course, a disastrous failure as president, who was a joke and a clown, who brought this country's economy to its knees, who continued giant spending, binge spending and deficit spending, and then called himself a conservative when he was spending and building federal bureaucracies like a left-wing socialist, together with the phony Republicans in the Congress. And so young voters saw all of that. And then they see this figure that the media is promoting as a savior, as a messianic type figure, Barack Hussein Obama. He's going to come in on his white horse or on his black horse and save the country, on his camel and save the country. And so young voters overwhelmingly responded to that because they've been so brainwashed by the media and by Hollywood and by the communist educational system and the communist schools that they go to. And yes, what they teach them in the schools, that's Marxism. That's Marxist philosophy. When they teach them not to believe in religion, when they teach them not to believe in the Constitution, when they teach them to support equalizing everything economically, those are all Marxist principles. If you read Das Kapital by Karl Marx and you read the Communist Manifesto, that comes right out of what Karl Marx proposed. And so young people, after all this brainwashing, after all these decades of brainwashing, this younger generation has become very left-wing. And look at all the media sources they go to. They go to YouTube. They go to Google. They go to Facebook. They go to Twitter, all controlled by the far left. And so everything they see, the music they hear, the movies they watch, the television they watch, the internet that they go to, everything is super left, far left. All the comedians on television, all the comedians that they see mock Republicans and conservatives and people believe in the Bible, and all of that is mocked and ridiculed and made fun of, and the only cool thing is being a leftist, being pro-black, being pro-Muslim. That's what's cool. That's what's in. And they convinced enough idiotic, ignorant young people to go along with that. But now we see that there's a website that doesn't work, that the number one program, the ultimate signature program of the Obama administration, which was Obamacare, not only is the website not working, when it does work, it's even worse than when it doesn't work, because when it does work, people see that their premiums are going up. They're paying more. When Obama promised they would pay less, he promised their premiums would go down by $2,500 a year. Their premiums are going up in most cases. He promised that no one would ever have to give up the doctor they prefer and the healthcare program they prefer. He said if you like the insurance you now have, you will not have to give it up. Period, he said. And he promised over and over again. We did a great video, actually Shlomo did a great video showing that, you know, documenting how Obama promised over and over and over again, explicitly promised, swore to the American people, you will not have to change your health insurance. You will not have to change your doctors. You will not have to change anything if you like what you currently have. And now millions of people are getting notices that their health insurance has been canceled. Their policies have been canceled. And that if they want to get insured again, it's going to be much more expensive and much more difficult. Millions. Obama lied. Everything sold to the American people was one big example of takia, of lying. And there's a backlash building. If this continues, we have a shot. We actually have a chance if this continues. This is what we said. This is what we needed. We needed this backlash. Now, again, I don't know how the left-wing media and Hollywood and the establishment is going to convince the American people, because they're going to do everything they can to convince the American people once the website's up that really things aren't that bad, that things are really good, and that the Republicans, after all, are even worse. That's what they're going to try to convince people of. And if they can convince them of that, we're still going to lose, and that's the end of America. America will fall apart. Because if Hillary Clinton gets elected, that's it. It's over. Okay? It's over if that happens. Because with the demographics going the way they are in this country, if this does not stop very quickly, it becomes irreversible. You're going to have a non-white majority. It becomes irreversible. The entire United States becomes like New York or California, becomes overwhelmingly left-wing, and there's no hope for turning it around. California was once a conservative Republican state that elected Ronald Reagan overwhelmingly twice as governor. 1966, 1970, Ronald Reagan overwhelmingly was elected governor of California. Then when he ran for president twice, he overwhelmingly carried his home state of California, overwhelmingly. He got 59% of the vote in 1984 running for re-election as president in California. That was California only 30 years ago. Today, California is overwhelmingly left-wing because of the demographic changes, because of the invasion of the state. If this happens nationally, which is the trend, it's happening nationally. You're going to see states like Texas and states like Florida are going to become like California. State after state is going to fall, and the whole country nationally will be one big California. And when that happens, that's the end of America. That's the end of America. When all of America votes like New York and Massachusetts and California, this will be a socialist country. That will be the end of America. You're going to lose your freedoms. Your taxes are going to go through the ceiling. You're going to have the same crazy policies they have in socialist countries in Europe. Third world people are going to take over. You look at your big cities, your inner cities, where you have majority non-white populations. That's going to be the whole country. That is the nightmarish future of America. If this continues, unless there's a backlash and unless we get a president that actually is willing to really turn the situation around. And as far as Israel's concerned, we've gone over a million times why this is disastrous for Israel. Look at Iran getting close to building nuclear bombs, and Obama continues lying and cheating and playing games with the Israelis and pressuring the Israelis not to do anything about it. He's telling Congress not. He even wants to eliminate the sanctions they have, even economic sanctions on Iran. He wants to eliminate, and wants Israel to go back to the pre-67 borders. Hillary Clinton, she will continue. She did all of the same things when she was Secretary of State and when she was the First Lady under Bill Clinton. saying anti-Israel policy. She's a Jew hater, a vicious Jew hater, and we're going to expose her long history of vicious anti-Semitism. I mean, vicious anti-Semitism. I don't know if all of our great JTFers are aware of her long history of anti-Semitism, calling people Jew bastards, and calling Clinton's former campaign manager a Jew bastard, and calling Clinton the big Jew. Every time he cheated on her, she called him a Jew. Everybody she hates, every time she gets angry, she uses the word Jew to curse at people. I mean, she is a real Nazi anti-Semite. This is like putting Eva Braun in the White House. And she's the front runner. She's leading in all the polls. But her approval ratings are down. She's still leading the Republican candidates in all the polls, but her approval ratings are down now, substantially. Substantially down. She went down from 56% approval, positive approval rating, to 46% in the latest NBC Wall Street Journal poll. She now has below 50% approval rating. And that, if that continues, you know, that eventually could potentially make it difficult for her to run against Republican candidates. It'll make it a close race. It'll give us a shot at winning in 2016, God willing. That's at least what we're hoping for. But what's going to happen in 2016? Who's going to be the Republican alternative? Now, this is something we've also gone over many times. Is it going to be another McCain, another Romney, God forbid? Someone, you know, a traitor like Chris Christie or Rand Paul, these Muslim-loving anti-Semites, amnesty-supporting sellouts. Is that who the Republicans are going to nominate? Then it isn't even worth fighting Hillary Clinton because the Republican is just as bad as she is. Or is it going to be, for once, a candidate we can really be proud of and support enthusiastically like Ted Cruz? You know, not only have I been watching Ted Cruz's speeches supporting Israel and speaking out against Obamacare, I've been listening to his father, Rafael Cruz, who is a Southern Baptist preacher, Southern Baptist pastor, Rafael Cruz. And the way he speaks about, we must, if you don't bless Israel, God will curse you. If you curse Israel, God will curse you. If you bless Israel, God will bless you. Oh, he is great. He is fantastic. I see where his son now gets, you know, that Southern Baptist evangelical theology and philosophy. I've been listening to him. I saw a couple of his speeches lately. He leads pastors' missions to Israel. The only friend we have in the Middle East is Israel. The only friend we have. How would you like to have people like that think like that in the White House for a change? Oh. We're going to do the best we can to help. And I want us to play a major role in promoting this campaign. I want us to be a big player in helping Ted Cruz and Rafael Cruz and helping them get in the White House. I want us to be an important player in this. I know we don't have a lot of money. And I know that we dream big. We're supposed to dream big. Why not aim for, if we don't accomplish everything we want to accomplish, okay. But we should aim for big things. Let's aim for big things. And God willing, whatever we get, if we get 50% of what we aim for, or 40% of what we aim for, at least we're accomplishing something. But I always want to aim high and aim for big things. Doesn't mean we're going to get everything we want. We may only get a fraction of what we want, but even a fraction, at least we're making this a better world, and we do everything we can to get as much as we can to improve things. I just wanted to share with you, I know I've been speaking a lot about Ted Cruz lately, and you're going to hear a lot more. Hey, we got 3 more years till Election Day in 2016, so I got to warn our fellow JTFers, you're going to hear me speaking about Ted Cruz an awful lot. Because in Israel, I see the situation as being very bad. I think the Israeli government is terrible. The one place where I see a leader who seems to be becoming a prominent leader, who I really see as being good for Israel and as being good for America, the one place where I see that is with Ted Cruz. Are the odds against him? The odds are overwhelmingly against him. He's got to win the nomination first against the Republican establishment and against the news media and against every, they're all going to be against him. And then, even if he gets the nomination, he's got to go against Hillary Clinton. And all the establishment people are going to be backing Hillary Clinton. He's going to be stabbed in the back by all of them, including by Republican establishment people. They're going to stab him in the back. So, yes, it's an uphill battle. Yes, it's going to be very tough. No question about it. But he's a good speaker. He's a good debater. And he doesn't compromise. And he doesn't cave in. And he's not going to do what Romney did. And remember Romney in the debates? How he started praising Obama? It sounded like Romney was promoting Obama. He's running against Obama. And he starts praising all of his foreign policies and agreeing with everything he was saying. McCain did the same thing. That's not Ted Cruz. That is not Ted Cruz. I'm hoping that two things can happen. Number one, I want Ted Cruz to win, because if Ted Cruz wins, it's good for Israel, good for America, good for everyone. And secondly, I want our movement to be riding on this thing. We can become a big, important movement if we become a major part of this campaign, if it works out. This could help us ride on this movement, and if we become big and get money and become important and raise a lot of money, obviously that can be very helpful to us with what we want to do in Israel. That can get us into the Knesset in Israel. If we have money, we can get into the Knesset in Israel. And by the way, even if we have money, whether I'm in Israel or not, we have people in Israel who could run for the Knesset and get elected. And then they would make my not being allowed in Israel an issue day and night. And I would get in. In fact, if we had money, I'd get in even before the election for the Knesset. If money talks in Israel. If they saw that we have a big movement, they wouldn't be able to keep me out for long. And so, that's the situation. That's the situation. I know that, you know, I am a dreamer. There's no question about it. We're all dreamers. I was a dreamer when I was running JDL, and people told us we'd never be able to free Soviet Jews. They said, you're not going to free all of them. You'll only be able to free a few thousand at the most. They're not going to let them all out. They haven't let them all out in 60, 70 years. They're not going to change that policy. They're not going to let all their brains and their scientists and their engineers and all that Jewish brain power, they're not going to let that brain drain take place. They'll never allow that. We were told that was hopeless. And for 2,000 years, the Jewish people were told the resurrection of a Jewish state and the return of the Jews to their homeland is hopeless. So we're not impressed when people tell us something is hopeless. Yes, the odds are against us. They always are. But you never know. You never know when good things are going to come. And maybe, and again, I'm not saying that this is going to be, I'm not saying there aren't going to be ups and downs, and I'm not saying that when the website finally starts working, if they, you know, maybe that's going to solve some of Obama's political problems and some of Hillary Clinton's political problems now. Maybe, I don't know. I hope not. I hope that they continue to have nothing but problems and fall flat on their face. But maybe this is the beginning of a serious, serious problem for them. One thing's for sure, Obamacare will not work. I can tell you right now, it will not work. Don't listen to any of the so-called experts who say, oh, they're going to straighten it out. No, it will. Big government socialist takeovers do not work. The question is, will the American people, when they see this failure, be upset enough to turn to Ted Cruz and, yes, to turn to JTF? Because we want to be there too. We want to be part of that protest against this and part of the backlash. We want Ted Cruz in power in America, and we, JTF, our people, Hayamin Amiti, we want to be in power in Israel. Let's hope, God willing. Let's hope that we can ride this thing, we can build momentum with this thing, help us to build momentum with this thing, and let's hope that with that momentum it will strengthen us in America and in Israel. God willing. Just wanted to share with you some of that, and so that you'll also understand why for the next couple of years you're going to be hearing me speak about these things an awful lot. And you're going to see an awful lot of videos from us. You know, if Shlomo's involved, they're going to be very high quality videos. You're going to see some great videos. By the way, we have great videos out there right now. Great videos. And you're going to see some more great videos, a lot more, God willing. There's a lot more where that came from. Just wanted you to know what we're doing, and just wanted you to know that Od lo avda tikvatenu, our hope is not yet lost. That's what the Jews said when they came out of Auschwitz and came out of the Holocaust. They had the song Hatikva, the hope, which is the name of the Israeli national anthem, and the peak of that song, the climax of that song, is Od lo avda tikvatenu, which means our hope is not yet lost. That's quite a statement coming from a people who saw all their families burned and gassed, who came with nothing but the clothes on their backs, and sometimes not even that, to a barren land surrounded by enemies who outnumbered them 100 to 1, in a world that always hated them and murdered them. And they still said, our hope is not yet lost. In reality, we're seeing again, our hope is not yet lost. You never know. This just might give us another shot. Wanted to share that with you. And now I just want to summarize by saying, you can help us. You can help us make this something successful. Imagine if we become a major part of the cruise campaign, and if the cruise campaign does take off. Wouldn't that be wonderful? I know it's an uphill battle, and I know it's David versus Goliath. But isn't it worth doing everything we can to give us a shot at this? Wouldn't it be wonderful if we succeeded? Help us with our Hebrew and English videos. When you see our great videos posted, and our videos are really good, especially the ones Shlomo does are just fantastic, and Shlomo's been doing the videos. I mean, really, really good videos. Help us by liking and favoriting and commenting and sharing and mirroring the videos. Help us with that. And help us on the forums and the Facebook pages with good posts and good threads so that people will want to join, and so that this will be a movement that people will be interested in and will be excited by our movement. And most importantly, of course, checks, money orders, cash donations sent to our post office box. So important. Our biggest downfall is money. If we had money right now, we could change Jewish history if we had a multi-million dollar budget. Right now. Within 1 year, we'd be a mass movement. Right now. But we make do with what we have. We need your support. Every check, every money order, every cash donation makes a difference. If people can send it through the regular mail to the post office box, or people can donate online using their credit card by going to our main pages. God bless the great JTFers who are helping us. God bless you. We need your help now more than ever. Let's get in this fight, and let's hope that, God willing, we have an opening here to make a difference, to give us some hope again. Okay. Now let's get to the questions from our great JTFers, which is something I always enjoy doing, of course. And we start out with our good friend Obama Scum out of USA Now, who writes, and I quote, Billy Roper of National Alliance on 9/11, quote, "We may not want them to marry our daughters, but anyone who drives a plane into a building to kill Jews is fine by me," unquote. Okay. Billy Roper, just so that you'll know, the National Alliance, by the way, the National Alliance is a neo-Nazi organization. They're open Nazis. They openly refer to themselves as Nazis, and their symbol is the swastika. I mean, these are Nazis. And yes, they praise the 9/11 attack that murdered 3,000 Americans. They claim that the people killed were all Jews, which, of course, is not true. There were Jews killed, no question about it. We know Jews who were murdered on 9/11. I personally know, unfortunately, several Jews that were murdered on 9/11. I also have some non-Jewish friends whose family members were murdered on 9/11. But the Nazi organizations and the Klan, these other organizations, praised what happened on 9/11. They were thrilled when it happened. They thought it was great. They support the Muslim terrorists. They support Al-Qaeda. They support the Muslim terrorists. That's a fact. That's very, very true. Thank you, Obama scum, out of USA Now. And we go now, we move on now to our good friend Wandering Samurai 81, who writes, and I quote, "Der Chaim, are most American blacks part white?" Unquote. Yes. Yes. You can see a tremendous difference between blacks who don't have white blood in them, the real African blacks. Have you ever seen really, really dark African blacks? They have no white blood in them. Many African blacks also have white blood in them because of the white colonialists that went through Africa. So you have a lot of white blood in, even in a lot of blacks. When I say African blacks, in other words, blacks who actually never came to America, who live on the continent of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. Many of them have white blood as well. But the real dark blacks with no white blood in them, you see that there's a tremendous difference in how they look and how those who are more mixed look. And the American blacks are mixed. Thank you, Wandering Samurai 81. And now we go to the great Joe Gutfeld, who writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, this week is the 75th anniversary of the famous War of the Worlds radio broadcast. Do you believe in life on other planets?" Unquote. I don't. No, I don't. And the Torah, Chazal, which is the Torah Shebe'al Peh, Chazal are the rabbinic sages, and the Torah Shebe'al Peh, which means the oral Torah, the Talmud, Mishnah. The Talmud says that there probably is not life on other planets. The way God set up the world, we probably are the only life. Our planet is the only planet that sustains life, probably. Doesn't say definitely, because we don't know definitely. Maybe God, for some reason, did decide to put life on other planets. It's possible, but the general belief is that probably not. There probably is not. Which is incredible, this gigantic universe God created for his glory. And the only planet where there's life is the planet Earth. That's what we believe is likely, which is a manifestation of God's great glory. Anyway, thank you, Joe Gutfeld. And now we go to our good friend Da Vinci, who writes, and I quote, "When Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, Lot's wife was turned into a pillar of salt because she looked back. Is there a deeper meaning of this passage?" Unquote. Okay, great question. Yes, of course, there are always much deeper meanings. You know, there are at least 70 different meanings for every passage, for every word in the Torah. There are at least 70 different revadim, layers, that we can study it by. And we believe, Shivim Panim La Torah, 70 faces of the Torah, at least, sometimes even more. Now, the question, one of the questions in Judaism was this for real? When she became a pillar of salt, did that really happen, or was this just part of a prophetic dream? Harambam teaches that was just a dream, that these were all prophetic dreams. Whenever you see angels appearing, Harambam says that angels are spiritual beings. There's no dispute that they exist. Angels definitely exist. There's no question about that. That's not symbolic. There are real angels. God has servants who are spiritual servants, but Harambam says they are not physical beings. They're only spiritual beings. So if someone sees an angel or speaks to an angel or hears from an angel, that's prophetic. And that is done when someone is dreaming, when someone is asleep. That's how that comes about. So Harambam claims that the pillar of salt, in fact, was something that was a prophetic vision that was seen in a dream. That it was not something that literally happened. It has very important meaning. Even these dreams have extremely important meaning, especially if they're included in the Torah, as this was. But he claims that it didn't literally take place. Now, his view there's a machloket. A machloket means a disagreement. The other great rabbinic sages disagree with him vehemently and say, no way, this really literally happened, that she literally turned into a pillar of salt, that these things really happened. So there's a difference of opinion, and people can decide, you know, whether they believe it was a prophetic dream or whether they believe it was, whether they believe it literally really happened. Whatever you want to believe, Sodom and Gomorrah, by the way, did exist. That there's no dispute about. And Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. That there's no dispute about. But how the destruction took place and what exactly happened there, were there prophetic dreams about the destruction, or is the Torah actually describing what actually took place? That's the first question. And again, I'm giving you both sides. There's one side of rabbinic scholars who say it really took place. This literally, physically took place. And there's another side that says, no, this was a prophetic dream. So you can choose whichever side you prefer. Now, she was told not to look back, Lot's wife. By the way, Lot's wife's name is Irit. You don't see that in the Torah, but it's in the Mishnah. The Mishnah is the oral Torah that God gave. God gave oral law. He gave an oral Torah to the Jewish people also at Mount Sinai, which is not part of the Bible, that describes and explains all of the commandments. Because how would we know you don't know what the commandments mean. You can't possibly understand what the commandments mean unless you have that oral explanation, the oral Torah. So God gave us an oral Torah, which we call the Mishnah. And the Mishnah says that Lot's wife's name was Irit. Irit was commanded by God along with Lot and his two daughters. The four of them, as they were fleeing from Sodom and Gomorrah, they were commanded by God not to look back. And there are a number of reasons why, but I'm going to give you one reason that I personally prefer. There are a number of reasons why this was so important, why they were told not to look back, and why we're told that she turned into a pillar of salt as a punishment when she did look back. The reason I think this took place is because they didn't want to leave. When they were told you have to leave because Sodom and Gomorrah are going to be destroyed because of their evil, God is going to destroy them, they didn't want to leave because Sodom and Gomorrah were extremely wealthy nations. They were city nations. There were cities and there were nation cities that had turned into nations, and they were very, very wealthy. And Lot went, actually, Lot, by the way, is Abraham. Lot is Abraham's nephew. And Lot went to his son-in-laws. He had two son-in-laws. He went to his two son-in-laws and he asked them to leave. They refused to leave. And he went to other people, and he went to several other people and asked them to leave. They would not leave, and they stayed in Sodom, and they were killed. When Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, they were killed. But he and his wife and his two daughters were actually pulled out by the angels. They actually were almost pushed out and pulled out. They didn't want to leave. They really didn't want to leave because they had money and investments, and they had, you know, materialistic investments there. And so they, even though it was a very wicked place, a terribly evil place where they had laws against giving, you had laws against giving charity, you had laws against helping people, you had laws against having guests come to your home and opening your home to guests, you had laws against this. I mean, it was, by law, you had to be cruel, which is, you know, you had laws. We saw this in modern times in Nazi Germany. And in Soviet Russia, you had similar laws that were very, very unbelievably cruel. And this type of cruelty was actually encoded in law in Sodom and Gomorrah. And that's why they had to be destroyed. These nations had to be destroyed because they were encoding in law wickedness and evil and outlawing anything righteous. And so they didn't want to leave. And when she turned back, it was as if she was looking back at something that she regretted having to leave. And that was a terrible sin. So the punishment is midah keneged midah, measure for measure, her punishment was, okay, you want to be with them, you want to stay with them, you're going to have the same fate as they are then. You're going to turn into a pillar of salt. Just like they are being destroyed, you're going to be destroyed as well, because you still, just for the sake of the money, you're still willing to identify with this pure evil that they have there, that you're willing to be part of this evil just for money, then you don't deserve to be saved, and you're also going to pay the price. That is the moral lesson, or at least one of the moral lessons that we can see when she turned back, when she looked back. Whether or not that actually happened in a dream, or whether or not it happened in physically in real life, that, you know, again, there's a difference of opinion among the rabbinic sages about that. That you can choose whatever you wish to choose, whatever view you wish to choose. Both views are legitimate. Thank you very much, Da Vinci. And now we go to the great Chicago Jew who writes, "Do you think the Rosenbergs should have been executed?" Unquote. Absolutely, they were complete traitors. They gave nuclear secrets that enabled the Soviets under Joe Stalin to develop nuclear bombs. The Soviets developed nuclear bombs because of what was stolen, the secrets that were stolen from the United States. And the Rosenbergs were part of the ring of spies that passed this information on to Stalinist Russia. Stalin, who had slaughtered thousands of Jews, who signed a pact with Hitler in 1939, joining with Hitler to carve up Poland, which was the beginning of the Holocaust and the end of Polish Jewry. Millions of Polish Jews were murdered because of that. This monster Stalin, this vicious Jew-killing Nazi monster Stalin, that's who the Rosenbergs wanted to help. I mean, what self-hating scum. Absolute and the danger, the treasonous betrayal of the United States, absolutely they should have been executed. And there's no question that they were guilty. No question that they were guilty. Thank you. I mean, if you follow the trial, there were witnesses and material evidence. I mean, the case, they had as much evidence against them as O.J. Simpson did, or as any other big trial. Where it's an open and shut case. There's no question they were guilty. Thank you, Chicago Jew. And now we go to our good friend Kalman Ben Menachem, who writes, and I quote, "Chaim, which Jewish sources is the Kahanist philosophy based on? Thank you," unquote. Okay, great question. Kahanist philosophy is based on the entire Torah, on the written Torah, Torah she'be'al peh, Torah she'bichtav, the written Torah, the oral Torah. It's based on all Torah Jewish sources. Kahanism is traditional Judaism, is traditional Torah Judaism. And you may say, well, how come all the, you know, the yeshiva world and all the other people, they don't follow it. They don't follow it because they're not following traditional Judaism. After thousands of years, they have lost the traditional Judaism that Kahanism is based upon. If you look at the way Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob reacted to enemies of the Jewish people and their views on Jewish survival and Jewish pride and Jewish honor and the lives of Jews, our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they were Kahanists. King David was a Kahanist. Look at what he did to his enemies. What David as a boy did to Goliath, that was Kahanism. That was what we did to the Soviet Union, taking on the Soviet Union. And it's what little Israel does fighting the whole Muslim world. Kahanism is traditional, true Torah Judaism. It's as simple as that. The entire Torah is what Kahanist philosophy is based upon. Thank you, Kalman. And now we go to the great Main Koran, who writes, and I quote, "One, is it okay that I hope Assad wins?" Unquote. Well, Bashar Assad, the dictator of Syria, is a very evil man. He's a butcher. He does want to destroy Israel. He hates the United States. He hates the West. He wants to destroy Israel. He's a vile mass murderer, and his father, Hafez al-Assad, was a vile mass murderer. But right now he's killing, the opposition against him are Al-Qaeda terrorists. and they're killing each other. I would say that I don't want either side to win. I want them to keep fighting, and I want them to kill each other. They're, both sides are just so evil. I mean, just so evil. The atrocities on both sides are unbelievable. I think both sides are just monstrous. I would agree with you that the Al-Qaeda terrorists who are opposing Assad are probably even worse than he is, not because he's less evil. I mean, both sides are completely evil, both committed to the destruction of all decent and good people. But simply because if he stays in power, this is going to continue. He's going to have a hard time ruling over Syria. There's a lot of instability in Syria when he's in power, and that's good. Because that means they're busy fighting each other and they're busy with each other instead of attacking everybody else, instead of attacking Israel, America, and the world. So that's good. On the other hand, if he's overrun, if he's defeated, then the Al-Qaeda Sunni majority are going to take over, and that would not be good. Then Syria becomes a major threat once again. And now, so I would say I don't want either side to win. I really don't want either side to win. But I would agree with you that the Al-Qaeda terrorists, from a strategic point of view, would be even more dangerous if they took over, simply because they're the majority of the population and they would turn Syria into a major threat again. Now, Mein Koran writes, and I quote, too, your thoughts on Putin, unquote. Vladimir Putin is a very evil man. He was a KGB operative and he was the head of the KGB in the Soviet Union. And he's still KGB. He's a communist dictator. He's like the old Soviet dictators. He's a murderer, a mass murderer. He's building nuclear bombs for Iran. He's the one who has given most of the material and most of the technology for Iran to build nuclear bombs. Most of it has come from Russia. He does everything he can to assist Iran in building the nuclear bombs and to protect Iran and cover up for Iran in what they're doing. And he does the same in all other areas. I mean, when it comes, wherever there's conflict, or wherever this is what Russia does. So he is a very, very evil person, and a very dangerous and a very evil person. I know that there's some people who are tempted to say because he was fighting with Obama over Syria, that there's some people who are, because they're against Obama, are tempted to support him instead. That's crazy. I mean, he's also very bad. I mean, they're both very bad. He and Obama are both terrible. That's like saying, that's like the self-hating Jews who said, we support Stalin because he's at war with Hitler, because eventually Hitler turned on Stalin and Hitler and Stalin were fighting each other. So all the Jews, so you had a lot of the self-hating Jews saying they supported Stalin. Stalin also wanted to murder the Jews. So it was also crazy, you know, the smart thing to do is to say we're against both of them. You know, we're against, both of them are terrible. And Putin versus Obama, when there are conflicts between Putin and Obama, both sides are terrible. Putin is an evil man. Anyway, thank you, Mein Koran. And now we go to the great Dr. Dan, who is the voice of reason, common sense, and logic. And the great Dr. Dan writes, and I quote, one, Jacob and Leah's relationship prior to marrying Rachel. Okay, unquote. Jacob is Yaakov. And he loved Leah, but he loved Rachel more. He married Leah first. He was deceived by Laban. He wanted to marry Rachel, and he worked for 7 years to marry Rachel. He made a deal, and Laban deceived him. And told him, and put Leah in the tent with him that night, and he wound up having relations with Leah, and he married Leah. He was married to Leah instead of to Rachel. So he was deceived. And then he had to work another 7 years to marry Rachel. It says in the Torah, it says that Leah was snua. Snua means hated, that she was hated. But it also says Yaakov also loved Rachel. Also means that he loved Leah. So it says that, in effect, what it says in the Torah, there are two things that seem to be a contradiction here. They're not a contradiction, but, you know, if you read it in a simplistic way, it would seem to be a contradiction. On the one hand, it says, it clearly seems to be saying that Yaakov loved Leah less than Rachel, but he loved Leah. And then it says that he hated Leah. And one other party says that she was snua. What's the meaning of that? The meaning is this. If you have two wives, which is something we don't recommend, but, you know, in his case, he didn't have a choice. If you have two wives and you love one more than the other, even if you love them both, but you love one more than the other, the one that you love less, it's as if she's being hated. It's as if you're hating her. And in fact, the word hate, the sina, in biblical Hebrew can mean not loving someone adequately, not loving them enough. So he did love Leah, but he loved her less than Rachel, and so it was as if he hated her. That's basically, it felt like he hated her to her, because she wanted to be loved as much as her sister Rachel was loved. Because he was married to two sisters, which is something, again, the Torah does not, now the Torah does not permit you to marry two sisters, but this was before the Torah was given. One of the examples of how much Yaakov loved Leah and how important Leah was, let's not forget that Leah had 6 out of the 12 sons of Yaakov. The 12 sons of Yaakov became the 12 tribes of Israel. And 6 out of the 12 tribes came from Leah. She was the mother of 6 out of the 12 tribes, including among the most important ones, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Issachar, and Zvulun. Those were the 6 tribes that came from Leah. Yehuda, Judah, is the tribe of the Malchut, of the kingdom. In other words, we're the rulers of Israel. King David is going to come from Yehuda, and the Messiah is going to come from Yehuda. So, obviously, very, very important. That's where the kings of Israel and the rulers of Israel will come from, the tribe of Yehuda. That comes from Leah. Levi is the tribe of the Kohanim. The Kohanim are the priests. It's the priestly tribes, also very important. The people that are going to be the priestly tribe, the ones that are going to be running Beit HaMikdash, the Holy Temple. So, very important, the 6 out of the 12 tribes and really, really important ones, and the really important ones came from Leah. Leah also had the only daughter, Dinah. They had one daughter. They had 12 sons and one daughter. And Dinah was the first daughter to be born to any of the fathers of the Jewish people. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are the fathers of the Jewish people. Abraham didn't have any daughters. With Sarah, and Yitzchak with Rivka did not have any daughters. The first time they had a daughter, and the only time they had a daughter, was through Leah. Dinah was their daughter. And it's a long story, but she was supposed to become the 13th tribe, and it's a long story, which I'm not going to go, it's not your question, so I'm not going to go into it. I don't want to get thrown off on that, because that's a long story also, the explanation of that and why that's significant. So Yaakov learned that Leah was essential to creating the Jewish nation, because she was the mother of 6 out of the 12 tribes, and he did love her. And now Dr. Dan writes, and I quote, too, how did Dov Hyken go from JDL to Democrat representative? Does he vote left or right? Unquote. Dov Hyken is a state assemblyman from Brooklyn, for those who don't know, from the Borough Park section of Brooklyn. He's an Orthodox Jew. He worked with me for years in JDL. I knew him very well, and we worked together for years. And yes, he went from JDL to becoming a politician. And he votes left or right. He votes whatever's good for his political career. I'm not saying he doesn't have any principles. He does have certain principles sometimes, but he's a politician. He's became a politician. He could have done. There are a lot of good things he could do even now. He could make the difference for JTF right now. I've gone to him. I've asked him in the past. I asked him to help. He could raise the money for us and make the big difference for us. But, you know, his political career is more important to him, and I think that's unfortunate. If he could be convinced to support us instead, you know, he could change Jewish history very dramatically, because he has fundraising as an assemblyman and a prominent assemblyman with many donors. He can raise big bucks for us, but I don't think he would do that. I think that when he raises big bucks, he wants to raise it for his own political campaigns, and that's unfortunate. That's unfortunate, because I don't think a political campaign in Brooklyn or in Borough Park, with all due respect, is as important as the survival of Israel. And what we're fighting for is the survival of Israel. But anyway, that's the Dov Hyken story. Thank you, Dr. Dan. And now we go to the great Lewinsky stinks, Dr. Brennan Rocks, who writes, and I quote, "Support for amnesty among whites under 40 is as high or higher than it is among Hispanics. Please discuss..." Oh, I'm sorry. Let me start with that, because the second part of your comment is a different subject. So let's start with this. Look, there's no question that young whites are very self-hating. They voted for Obama. How can you get more self-hating than that? I mean, they're Obama supporters. They support amnesty. They support gay marriage. They support abortion. They support all the things that are immoral. They support drug legalization. So there are a lot of things they support that are terrible. As I said in my opening, though, I'm hoping, God willing, that the backlash on Obamacare will give us a chance, maybe a chance, to move these people to the right. I hope and pray that can happen. Let's see what we can do. So I'm not giving up yet. Not giving up hope yet. If you listen to my opening, you'll see what I say about that. If there's a backlash and they see that Obamacare doesn't work, and they see that big government doesn't work, and they see that the left doesn't work, you never know what that could lead to. Why, young people were very left-wing in the 60s and 70s. Very left-wing. Even many of them were radicalized in the 60s. And then they moved all the way to the right and supported Ronald Reagan when they saw the disasters of Jimmy Carter and there was a backlash. So if we get that same type of backlash, maybe there's some hope for turning the situation around. I hope so, God willing. We'll see. Now Lewinsky stinks. Dr. Brennan Rocks says, and I quote, "Also, please discuss evil boy bands," unquote. Well, I mean, that's part of the culture that we have, a culture that encourages emptiness and stupidity among girls. You know, anything that encourages girls to believe in things to look for things that are empty and foolish, with music that stinks and music that's immoral. These are bad things. It's a bad trend. It represents something that's bad. Of course, it's bad. It's part of the evil, rotten culture that we have to create an alternative to. Otherwise, God will destroy America. Just like he destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, God will destroy America if we don't change the situation. Thank you, Lewinsky Stinks. And now we go to the great paper cut, who writes, and I quote, Chaim 1, "The APA just announced that pedophilia is now a sexual orientation. Please put a curse on them," unquote. Yeah, by the way, the APA is the American Psychological Association. They now say it was a mistake, that there was an error when they put that out, which is a lie. I mean, they want to justify and legitimize everything. I mean, these are the people that all the psychiatrists and all the psychologists who told us until the early 70s that homosexuality is a mental illness, which of course it is. You know, they said it was a mental illness, and if someone had said they were a homosexual and went to one of these psychologists or psychiatrists in the 1960s, for instance, or even in the early 70s, the general attitude was, well, we have to try to cure you. And they did. And by the way, they did cure people. I mean, they were curing people. But the feeling was that this is a mental illness and we've got to try to cure you or at least control this sick behavior. Then, under pressure from the so-called gay groups, they decided to eliminate that and say, no, 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 there's nothing wrong with it. It's fine. It's not a mental illness. So all these years, for hundreds of years, we were told it was a mental illness. And thousands of years, you know, we know that this is a mental illness. And the Bible tells us it's an abomination. In the 1970s, they decided to change all of that because of pressure from so-called gay groups. And we know that if you're going to legitimize homosexuality, it's going to lead eventually to legitimizing bestiality, pedophilia, all the other evil things. It's the end of society. It's a breakdown of all of society. So this is, you know, and the APA, the American Psychological Association, are the most cowardly, left-wing, disgusting traitors. I mean, left-wing, immoral scum who themselves, all of them, by the way, they themselves, not all of them, but the vast majority, are nuts. They themselves are nuts. Most psychiatrists and most psychologists are nuts. That's why they become psychiatrists and psychologists. They want to figure out why they themselves are crazy. They're insane. I'm not saying all of them. And there is a need for psychology and psychiatry, and there's a need for that. We have sick people, and there's a need to have people who are specialists in treating people who have mental illnesses. And there's a need also for treating people who are not crazy, who just have problems in life and need to speak to somebody. That, you know, I see the need for their profession. But the vast majority of people in their profession are themselves crazy and just make crazy people nuttier, even nuttier. Or just give them drugs and turn them into drug addicts. And many of them are drug addicts. Many of them take drugs. They're disgusting people. Disgusting people. And again, I want to emphasize there are exceptions to the rules. If there are decent psychologists and psychiatrists who are doing good work, more power to them. There's no question that there's a need for it. But again, the vast majority have proven over and over again, and this is another example. I mean, they issue a statement saying pedophilia is just a sexual orientation. I mean, these are sick people. Whoever issued that statement is a sick, evil, depraved person. And now Papercut writes, and I quote, too, Trey Gowdy, should he run for president, unquote. For people who don't know, he's a congressman from South Carolina, a very good speaker. He was a prosecutor for years, so he's a good speaker, a good debater. He seems to be a pretty genuine conservative. I'm not 100% thrilled with all of his votes on Israel. He voted to give aid to the PLO terrorists in Judea and Samaria, so I'm not thrilled with that. On other votes, though, he did vote on the side of Israel. So he needs a little work when it comes to that. Should he run for president? Maybe someday he should. I don't know. If we'll see. I mean, we'll see. I'm very, very careful because we've been burned so many times. I want to make sure that, you know, when we support somebody, that we're supporting somebody who's for real and who's not going to bend and not change and not break. In 2016, we wouldn't support him for president, and he shouldn't run for president, and I don't believe he's going to run in 2016. 2016, we're supporting Ted Cruz. But in future years, like 2020, 2024, whatever, you know, in future elections, could he be a possible candidate for president? Maybe. I don't know, maybe. Thank you, Papercut. And now we go to the great Binyamin Yisrael, who writes, and I quote, why did Mo Muzi appoint a Republican for senator for a few months and not for the entire remainder of Lautenberg's term? Now we are stuck with Booker, unquote. Very true. And Mo Muzi, for those of you who don't know what Binyamin is referring to, Mo Muzi is Chris Christie, Machshmova Zichro Shem Reshaim Yirkav. That left-wing, filthy animal, Chris Christie, or Crisp Crispy. Anyway, this beast, whose doctor, you know, I mean, I just can't get over it. I mean, his doctor said he's in perfectly normal. There's nothing wrong with physically. He's perfectly normal. Perfectly normal. It's perfectly normal for some, maybe for someone who weighs 700 pounds, he's perfectly normal. I mean, what are you kidding me? And what type of doctor is this? Perfectly normal? Anyway, even Mitt Romney, you know, one of the reasons Mitt Romney didn't pick him as a running mate, because Mitt Romney was considering picking this animal as his running mate. One of the reasons he didn't pick him was for health reasons. He refused to give Mitt Romney his medical records. You can imagine what an honest medical checkup of this guy would reveal. You know, I mean, his blood type is Ragu. An honest review of his medical records would be a nightmare. Anyway, why did he pick Cory? Why did he just pick a Republican senator for a few months when he could have picked? We could have picked a Republican senator for the remainder of Lautenberg's term because he wanted Cory Booker to be in the Senate. He's very good friends for many years with Cory Booker, who was the left-wing black Democrat from Newark, New Jersey. And he wanted his good friend Cory Booker to, he knew Cory Booker was going to win. And he wanted him to get elected. That's why. You have to understand, Crispy gets along very well with every left-wing Democrat. He's like John McCain. He gets along well with the Democrats and hates all the Republicans. He especially hates Ted Cruz and hates the Tea Party people, and, you know, the real conservatives he despises. And so, you know, but he loves Democrats. He gets along very well with Democrats, gets along very, very well with the news media. And, you know, we know how well he gets along, of course, with his boyfriend, Barack Hussein Osama. Barack Hussein Osama, and he, of course, went for long strolls on the beach after Hurricane Sandy and holding hands on the beach like the nice couple that they are. And he was praising Barack Hussein Osama on television day and night before the election. I believe that Crispy might have been the decisive factor that reelected Obama. Because the media grabbed, they love this. They did interview after interview with him. He did dozens of interviews praising Obama to the high heavens days before the election in 2012. And Obama won 51% to 48%. So a swing of just 2 points to Romney, and Romney would have won. 2% swing and Romney would have won. It was 51% to 48%. So, and every poll showed that the Hurricane Sandy and the whole situation with Chris Christie and saying that Obama's helping and he's so wonderful and he's such a great leader and he's showing what a commander-in-chief he is and he's taking charge and he cares about people and he's helping. You know, all those things he was saying in the last days of the campaign had a big impact on the voters. There's no question about that. So he probably was responsible for Obama getting reelected. He likes left-wing Democrats. And by the way, in the latest polls, he is leading in South Carolina and in New Hampshire among Republican voters in the latest polls. So you see that people are still, I mean, we still deal with the fact that America needs a giant couch, a national couch. People are nuts. People in this country have become nuts. Just nuts. How could any Republican support this guy after what he did? How could any Republican support him? It's beyond understanding. And yet he's a front-running candidate for the Republican nomination. I hope and pray, God willing, that Ted Cruz beats him. But he's a front-running candidate. Thank you, Binyamin. And now we go to the great LKZ, who writes, and I quote, "Because of scandal, Justin Trudeau set to lead Canada. He did Shada on film in a mosque. Ideas," unquote. You're absolutely right. Justin Trudeau is anti-American, left-wing. He's an anti-Semite, like his father. His father was an anti-Semite. And his father was anti-Israel, and so is Justin Trudeau. Just a disgusting, empty suit a big nothing. And, you know, I don't know why Canadians are so thrilled about him. I mean, just, you know, pathetic. I know that there's scandal, and I know that there's corruption, and I know that there are problems in Canada. But I think the current prime minister certainly is a lot better than this. You know, I mean, Stephen Harper, whatever you want to say about him, Stephen Harper left at least the economy in Canada is actually better than the economy in the United States under Stephen Harper. When Trudeau's father was Prime Minister of Canada, the economy was terrible. So, I mean, why would people, you know, why would people want to do something like this? It's crazy. I don't know what to say. I mean, the polls show that Trudeau has an overwhelming lead and that the Conservative Party is going to lose. That's what the polls show in Canada. It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate. It's crazy. It's crazy. Big mistake. Big mistake. And now LKZ writes, and I quote, "Are we allowed to carry keys and bus pass on Shabbat?" Unquote. Keys you definitely are allowed to carry, obviously. You've got to open the door to your home. You're allowed to carry keys. You're not allowed to carry a bus pass, no. Thank you, LKZ. And you're not allowed to board a bus either, of course. Can't board a bus and you can't ride in any vehicles on Shabbat. Thank you, LKZ. And now we go to the great Tag Mechir Tzedek, who writes, and I quote, "Birkot Haminim, who is the Malchut HaRasha? Is it Rome? Who can we mindfully include? Can we include the secular Israeli government as well?" Okay, that's the first question. Okay, Birkot HaMinim is the one where we curse. That's the cursing prayer that we say every day. Three times a day we say this prayer. Four times on Shabbat. 5 times a day on Yom Kippur. And it's part of the Shmoneh Esrei. Shmoneh Esrei means the 18 prayer requests that we make in our prayers. It's actually 19 because of this. This was actually the 19th. This was added. And Tag Mechir is asking, who is Malchut HaRasha? When it says that we pray for the destruction of the evil kingdom, the kingdom of evil. Who is that? Tag Mechir is asking. That is every evil kingdom and every evil institution that works to destroy and hurt the Jewish people. And that does include self-hating Jews. Most of that prayer is about self-hating Jews. So it does include the secular Israeli government, those in the secular Israeli government that are trying to destroy the Jewish people, they are part of the prayer. We have to be careful when we have this type of severe cursing against our fellow Jews. We have to be careful. Because we're praying for their death in the prayer. We're praying against them in this world and in the next. It's a very, very severe curse. So we have to be careful. But certainly, when someone is part of the Erev Rav and is trying to destroy their own people and is endangering their own people, endangering the very survival of their own people, and has Jewish blood on their hands, as many Israeli politicians do, those Israeli politicians who have Jewish blood on their hands, who are giving away the land of Israel, expelling their fellow Jews, committing national suicide, brainwashing Jews and lying to Jews and distorting Jewish thinking and destroying Jews spiritually and physically, those individuals are part of the prayer. Those individuals who go that far are part of the prayer. Is it possible that some of them will eventually do tshuva? It depends who you're speaking about. Shimon Peres can never do tshuva for what he did. The crime of Oslo and all the things he did are too severe. So it depends which politicians you're speaking about. Thank you, Tag Mechir. And now we go to... Oh, I'm sorry. We have a second one here. Perush HaMakabi Shiur. Okay, which means a lesson on Perush HaMakabi. Perush HaMakabi is one of the great books that our leader, Harav Meir Kahana, Zecher Tzaddik V'Kadosh Livracha, Hashem Yikom Damo, wrote. Rabbi Kahana always used to write about how when Israel disobeys God, what must happen? When Israel disobeys God, eventually God has to punish Israel, unless Israel disobeys God and God has mercy and forgives and Israel changes in the short term, changes and repents, then God can mercifully forgive. But if Israel persistently, stubbornly disobeys God, then God has to punish eventually. Because if not, it looks as if the evil that's being done is acceptable. If Israel flourishes and lives in peace and lives in prosperity and everything is wonderful and they're doing evil, then it looks like their evil behavior is acceptable to God. And that's just not something that God can live with. Also, when there's no punishment, there's no tikkun, there's no correction. Sometimes punishment is designed to correct evil behavior. So we can't have a situation where it looks like evil is acceptable, and we can't have a situation where there's no correction of the evil behavior. We can't have that. And so eventually, consistent evil behavior brings punishment from God. There's no question about that. And I'm talking about on a national level now, not on a private level, not on a personal. On a personal level, it's even more acute. But I'm talking about even on a national level. Now, one of the things that, now, this is, why is this so terrible? When God has to punish Israel, it's absolutely terrible. It's a nightmare when God has to punish Israel. And why is it so terrible? Why is it such a chilul Hashem, such a desecration of God's name? And again, what I'm speaking to you about is what Harav Kahana wrote, and he cites sources, and it's just magnificent the way he does it in Pirush HaMakabi. I don't have the book in front of me, so I can't cite the sources, but this is classic Torah Judaism. It's a chilul Hashem, it's a desecration of God's name, whenever Hashem punishes Israel. Because number one, it makes God look cruel. Now we know that God is chesed, God is kindness and love and compassion. God is good. When God is forced by Jewish sin to punish the Jewish people, it makes God look cruel. And so that's a desecration of God's name when God is made to look cruel. Because of course God is the opposite of cruel. And then it's a desecration of God's name because it makes it appear in the eyes of certain many people among the nations of the world believe there is no God when they see the Jews are defeated or when they see the Jews are punished, when they see Jews are killed, God forbid, or punished or defeated, or put in exile, God forbid. To many people, that means there is no God. They say, oh, where's your God now? You're supposed to be God's people, the people of the Bible. Look at this. Where's your God? If God was, that was one thing the Germans always told the Jews in the concentration camps. Where's your God now? Tell God to help you now, while they were throwing Jews in the ovens and the gas chambers. There is no chilul Hashem. There's no desecration of God's name worse than that. And of course, the worst punishment, Rabbi Kahana always said, was the galut. When Jews are expelled from their homeland and thrown into the galut, the exile. And the greatest reward before final redemption is when we do have a Jewish state and Jewish sovereignty and return to our homeland. That's the greatest reward before the final redemption. The final redemption, of course, is going to be a whole change of everything. Eternal life, resurrection of the dead, Techiyat HaMetim, resurrection of the dead, and all other types of wonderful miracles that are going to occur. But until that happens, until we see those miracles occur, like resurrection of the dead and God openly ruling in the world, in the present circumstances where God does not openly rule in the world, where his presence is not openly manifested, the best reward is when we have a Jewish state, Jewish homeland. That's our number one reward, and our number one punishment is when we lose that. That's all from Pirush HaMakabi. Thank you, Tag Mechir. And now we go to the great Mishma, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim. How has Obamacare affected you and your loved ones? May Hashem bless you always. Unquote. Okay, great question, Mishmat, as always. It has affected me personally, because it's going to cost me money, personally, on a personal level. I'm probably going to pay the fine, at least the first year. I'm going to pay the fine. Either that, or I don't know what I'm going to do. I mean, it has a negative impact on me personally. An even worse impact on my mother. I have an elderly mother. She, thank God, she's in good health, but she needs obviously to have health insurance. She's, you know, I mean, I'm going to be 57 years old in a few weeks. My mother's up there in age, as you can imagine. And she needs health insurance, even though she, thank God, is in good health right now. But she needs the health insurance. And her premiums and everything else is going way up. Everything is going up. This is really, really hurting the elderly. It hurts young people and it hurts the elderly. The only people it helps are lazy, ghetto, inner city pieces of garbage who don't work, don't produce, don't do anything and get everything for free. They're the ones who are benefiting. Everybody else is going to get hurt by this. Other people, the vast majority of people, are going to be hurt by this, especially the elderly and young people. Young people coming into the workforce and just starting, they're going to get hurt badly, and elderly people are getting hurt by this. Thank you, Mishmat. And now we go to our good friend Corey Deserved It, who writes, and I quote, "In a laissez-faire capitalist society where government and business are completely separate, a monopoly is possible," unquote. You can have monopoly, it can lead to monopoly capitalism, which is why I don't think you should have complete laissez-faire. I think that this is an area where government has to intervene. When you have complete government monopolies, creating monopoly capitalism, that shouldn't be acceptable. Government should have the power, through antitrust laws, to break up big companies and force competition. We have to have competition. We can't have giant companies taking over a whole sector of the economy, one big company. You can't have just Google. Google is a monopoly. It should be broken up, and we should have competition when it comes to search engines. YouTube, all right, that's a monopoly which, you know, you can't really break up because other people have a right on the internet to create alternatives to YouTube. Unfortunately, they haven't. They haven't created big alternatives, in other words. YouTube still absolutely dominates in the area of uploading videos. But when it comes to search engines and search vehicles on the internet, Google absolutely monopolizes in a way which, even though you do have other search engines and you do have other people that are trying to get into it, but, you know, monopolies like Microsoft and Google, these monopolies really do devastating damage. Because the more competition you have and the more of a more free market you have, the better it is. And government, that's one area, one of the few areas where I do think there should be intervention to make sure that there is a free market and there's as much competition as possible. There should be substantial competition in major areas of the economy. You can't allow 1, 2, 3, 4 companies just to take over and choke out everybody else. Thank you, Corey Deserved It. And now we go to the great EB22, who writes, and I quote, "As PM of Israel, which countries or block of countries would you cut off diplomatic relations with that Israel currently has relations with?" Unquote. Great question, EB. There are, I think, Egypt and Jordan are two Muslim countries that hate Israel and that do damage. I think there are also certain third world countries which we'd have to study on a case-by-case basis. There are certain third world countries that Israel gives assistance to and has trade with, and it's all one-way trade where the Jews are basically giving them money and buying them off because the Jews feel good when they have diplomatic relations with countries, which is so stupid. Who cares? What do we waste money on embassies and diplomats and all this other stuff in these godforsaken jungle bunny countries that always hate us and that vote against us? And the, I mean, just it's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, we would study case by case, and we would do what is in the best interest for the survival of Israel. And some of these countries, there's no point in having diplomatic relations with some of these countries. We would decide. Some of them, we would just downgrade our relationship. Instead of having an embassy, we'd downgrade it. We'd work out some sort of arrangement where businessmen, if they're Israeli businessmen that want to do trade, that's fine. But we don't want, you know, we don't want to have, the Israel's diplomatic expenses for a little country are ridiculous. They go through such crazy extremes, these Jews, because they so want to be loved and so want to be accepted. It's just insane. We couldn't care less about that. The only thing we'd be interested in is this serving the cause of Israel's survival and making Israel a strong Jewish state? That's the only thing we'd be interested in. We're not interested in, do you accept us? Do you not accept us? You don't accept us? Don't accept us. Fine. Thank you, EB22. And now we go to the great secular believer who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, what do you think of Republicans saying stand back and let Obamacare fail instead of actively opposing it? I think it is evil and cowardly, unquote. Secular believer, I think you know that I agree with you. I think if you've seen our videos, you've seen that obviously we agree. Obviously that's our position. Our position is that you can't. First of all, it is very evil to say you're going to let all these people suffer because you think you're going to score some political points in the end. That is just not the way to do things. No. You have to care about the people. If you're a political party and you're real leaders, you have to care about the people that you're serving. You have to care when they suffer. You have to be there to try to prevent them from suffering. You don't want to let government pounce on them and drastically increase their premiums or throw their or knock them off their insurance policies and scare all the, you know how many elderly people I know who are in their 70s, 80s, 90s, people in their 90s who are very frightened now, who are facing big increases in expenses in their monthly expenses, in their co-pays. I mean, they're some of these people have a hard time getting by right now. They live on Social Security. And these people are being frightened and being given all types of problems in their, you know, at a time when they're very vulnerable. You don't do that to people. And if Republicans have any morality, they're going to stand up and fight this the way Ted Cruz was. He did, at least he tried his best, and he's not stopping, and he made it a big central issue. And I think he deserves a lot of credit for it. Thank you, secular believer. And now we go to our good friend Gimatria, who writes, and I quote, Chaim, your thoughts on Agudat Yisrael of America and the affiliated World Agudat Israel. I think Agudat Yisrael in America and in Israel are hideous organizations. They were formed to fight against the creation of a Jewish state, to fight against Zionism, which means the creation of a Jewish state. They were against the creation of a Jewish state. They support giving up Jewish land. Agudah in Israel supported the expulsion in Gush Katif, for instance, the expulsion of 10,000 Jews from Gush Katif and the destruction of their homes and synagogues. They weren't all, but 80% of them were religious Jews. About 80-85% of the Jews in Gush Katif were religious Jews. Their synagogues and the yeshivas were destroyed, burned to the ground. Their loved ones in their cemeteries in Gush Katif, in their cemetery, their bodies were disturbed and moved to other cemeteries so that they could hand over all the land to the Hamas and PLO terrorists who now fire rockets into Israel. I mean, disgusting. And Aguda supported them because they wanted the government money for their institutions. That's Aguda, that's Shas, that's all of these groups. You know, hideous. And Gimatria now writes, do you like visiting Borough Park? Unquote. Gimatria, I don't like seeing Jews anywhere outside of Eretz Yisrael. And in Borough Park, there are all these religious Jews, the Hasidic Jews, the Haredi Jews. All these Jews live outside of Israel. I think it's terrible. I think the homeland for the Jewish people is in the land of Israel, and especially religious Jews. I mean, come on. I mean, now that we have the land, they pray three times a day for Eretz Yisrael and Jerusalem and all that. I mean, this is what the prayers are filled with requests in regard to that. And we prayed for this and dreamed of this and gave our lives for this and were willing to die for this. And now now that we have a Jewish state for 65 years. 65 years now we have a Jewish state and they live in Brooklyn? And they call themselves religious Jews? I mean, give me a break. So, no, I don't like visiting Borough Park. or places like that. I want to tell all the Jews there, let's you should get out of there, go to Israel. That's your homeland. Thank you, Gimatria. And now we go to the great Maimonides, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, why is race so important to people? Are we naive to ignore it when judging people? Unquote. Well, I think that race, I mean, there's some people who are obsessed by race, but I do think that race, I wouldn't say that race itself, that the color of someone's skin is important. That I don't believe. I don't believe that the color of someone's skin should be important. But unfortunately, the vast majority of black people are filled with hatred for whites in general and for Jews in particular, even though the Jews did everything to help them and are still doing everything to help them. And they despise the Jews and want to destroy Israel and hate the Jewish people. Look at this animal we have in the White House. He does everything to try to destroy Israel. So, you know, when you see a black leader or a black politician or black people, I think there's a natural understanding there that there's a much greater likelihood that you're dealing with racists and anti-Semites. When you see black people in the streets or in the other place, you know, if you're worried, the chance that you're going to be confronted by crime is much greater than if you see a white person, if you see white people. I mean, that's just a fact of life. Are we supposed to ignore that? Are we supposed to pretend that isn't true? 98% of the violent crime in New York City is committed by non-whites. 98%. So who are we kidding here? I mean, who are we kidding here? Does that mean that we should automatically judge people by the color of their skin? No. But we also shouldn't be blind to reality. Thank you, Maimonides. And now we go to the great Ephraim ben Noach, who writes, and I quote, how does Obama think he's going to get away with purging and harassing the military? Unquote. Well, he has, of course, he's always been against the military. He hates the military. Bill Clinton always hated the military. Bill Clinton wrote that he hated the military. I mean, you know, they actually have a letter from Bill Clinton. When he was young, they got a letter of him where he writes how he despises the military. I forgot the exact word he used, but he said that he despises the military, or loathes the military, or despises. I forgot the word, whether he said despises or loathes. But he said he hates the United States military. He hates the soldiers of the United States and the military of the United States. And Bill Clinton was elected president even after saying something like that. So that's why they think they can get away with it, because they get elected even though they're against the people that are defending the United States. And now Ephraim ben Noach writes, and I quote, short talk on last week's parasha and haftarah. God bless. Okay. This week's, or this past week's Haftarah was Parashat Toldot. And in Parashat Toldot, we have Yitzchak, Isaac, who wants to give his blessing now to Esav, Esau. Isaac wants to give his blessing to Esau. He wants to give the main blessing to Esau. And he would give a secondary blessing to Yaakov, to Jacob. But Yitzchak's wife, Rivka, intervenes, and she goes to Yaakov, to the younger brother, and says, no. You've got to pretend that you're really Esau. And you've got to convince your father you're really Esau and get the blessing from your father. You're the one that should get the blessing. Because she knew Rivka was a prophetess, and she knew through prophecy that Yaakov was going to be the one who deserves the blessing, not Esav, not the evil Esav. But the question is, Yitzchak was also a prophet. He was blind, but he lost his sight in his last years. But he knew prophetically, he knew that Yaakov was righteous, and he knew that Esav was wicked. So why did he want to give this blessing to Esav, a wicked person, instead of giving it to Yaakov, the righteous person? That's the, you know, because Yitzchak, of course, was very righteous. Why wouldn't he want to give it to his righteous son, Yaakov? Why would he want to give it to an evil murderer and beast like Esav, like Esau? And the answer is because Yitzchak recognized, unlike some of the Jews of our generation, he recognized that the Jews need a Jewish state and Jewish leaders. That means strong military leaders, strong political leaders. The Jews need someone to run a Jewish state. That's essential for the redemption. Esav was a strong leader. He was evil. He was murderous. He was a beast. But he was a strong leader. And so Yitzchak figured, okay, he's evil, but he can do tshuva, he can repent. And then his children's children, they'll be righteous. They'll become righteous. They'll repent, they'll become righteous, even if their father and their grandfather and so on was evil. So he figured that's not a problem. Okay, he's evil, but, you know, that doesn't mean that the seed that comes after him will be evil. They could become righteous. And so he wanted the strong leader, Esav. Yaakov was not a strong leader. He was not considered to be a strong leader because he was very shy. He wasn't charismatic, but he was righteous. But he wasn't a strong leader. So Yitzchak said, he's wonderful. He's a wonderful person, but he's not a strong leader. Rivka, though, was the one who was right, his wife. She knew that it should be the other way around. She knew that Yaakov may not be a strong leader right now, but he will become a strong leader. He will learn to become a strong leader because Hashem will help him do that. God will help him do that. And that eventually happened. Yaakov became a strong leader and turned, his name was changed from Yaakov, from Jacob, to Yisrael, to Israel, when he became a strong leader. Yisrael is the strong leader. Yaakov is the Jew of the ghetto and the less strong leader. Esav, on the other hand, Rivka understood that Esav would not do tshuva, would not become righteous. And that what he produced, his children, grandchildren, so on, and seed, would continue to, in his evil ways. She understood that. So in the end, Yitzchak wants to give the blessing to Esav and a lesser blessing to Yaakov, but because of a deception, because he was deceived into thinking, he was blind, so he couldn't see, so he was deceived into thinking that Yaakov was Esav, he wound up giving Yaakov the main blessing. He blessed Yaakov in this world and in the next world. And when Esav came for his blessing, he only blessed him in this world. What does that mean? Yitzchak's blessing for Yaakov, Isaac's blessing for Jacob, was for this world and in the next world. In other words, he blessed him in this world and he blessed him in the next world, giving him eternal life in the next world. Esav does not have eternal life. He will not be he's not blessed in the next world. As long as he follows in the path of Esav, as long as he can, there may be some of his seed may eventually become righteous and follow in the right path, but most of them will not. So that was the difference in the blessing. But in this world, he will have power and he'll establish kingdoms and so on and so forth. Esav became many of the countries in the Western world, or the, you know, or the legacy of Esav. But anyway, including Amalek. But anyway, in the end, Rivka was right, and it was appropriate to give the blessing to the righteous person and not to the wicked person, even if the wicked person seems to be a strong leader. And there's a very important lesson here. Don't be swayed by a strong leader, by a strong charismatic leader, if that person is immoral and evil. That is not someone that you should be following. The first thing you should want to see in a leader, of course, it's good if a leader is charismatic and if he's strong. Those are good characteristics in a leader. But the first thing you want to see in a leader is that it's a righteous, good person, a moral, righteous, good person. That's the first thing you want. That's the foundation that's essential. That's what you have to look for first. So that's one of the aspects of this week's parasha. And as far as the haftarah is from Shmuel Aleph. Shmuel Aleph is the book of Samuel, the first book of Samuel. And this haftarah is called Machar Chodesh. And this is the haftarah about when David was running away from Shaul, Saul, the first king of Israel, who wanted to murder David, who was jealous of David and wanted to murder him. And Shaul's son, Jonathan, was protecting David and trying to help David. And Shaul became furious with his son and then eventually threatened his son. I mean, it was a very ugly situation. And it shows what happens when leaders don't follow what God commands them to do and then allow ego and personality to distort their view of what's best for the world. Leaders should be chosen, and kings should be chosen on the basis of what's best for the nation and for the world. That's what people should make their choice based upon. Not based upon ego, and not based upon personality conflicts, and not based upon childish feuding. That should not be the basis. And we see that in this week's Haftarah. So it's also the Haftarah is parallel to the Parasha. They're both about leadership qualities and what's important in leadership qualities. Thank you very much, Ephraim. And let me see here. Boy, this was a really long show this week. Yeah, 1 hour and 43 minutes. Wow. Anyway, I enjoyed doing every second of it. Until next week, Shalom.